broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men, leaning together, headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion. Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom remember us, if at all, not as lost, violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. T.S. Eliot, the opening of his poem, The Hollow Men, from 1925. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Adam Wood, filling in for Harold Wilson. Truth and its traveling companion, lying, appear to be very much on the nation's mind these days. The nature of our current acerbic political dialogue, for example, fueled by the daily bombardment of ideas and opinions from ubiquitous social media platforms, has not only served to harden our political divisions, but has sown general confusion about not only what is true, but about the very nature of truth itself. We hear quite often that we are living in a post-truth era where there is no such thing as quote-unquote objective truth. Remember that the denial of objective truth didn't begin with the 2016 election. The denial of scientific facts about smoking, evolution, climate change, vaccinations, and others have attempted to erode our confidence in objective truth for some time now. Today's Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, is the first in a three-part series dedicated to the discussion of truth. We will look at the nature of truth and what it might mean to live in a post-truth era. The second program will focus on social media and its effect on cultural attitudes towards truth. And on the third, we'll talk about truth and its specific relation to politics. My guests today are Don Rush, Associate Program Director and Senior Producer of News and Public Affairs at Delmarva Public Radio, Timothy Stock, Chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Salisbury University, and I am Adam Wood, Chairman of the Department of English at Salisbury University and Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. Welcome, gentlemen.
Certainly.
Thanks for having us.
Don, let me begin with you, and Tim, feel free to jump in as soon as you'd like to. Are we living in a post-truth era, and what does that mean?
Well, let me approach this first of all from a journalist's point of view. And that is that as a journalist, you have an event that's outside of ourselves, say, for instance, a police shooting. So as a journalist, what you try to do is you try to interview the police, you interview the victim if he's still alive, you interview the witnesses, you take a look at the forensic evidence, and so on and so forth. And what you get is sort of a flaw that's sitting in the middle of a faceted diamond, in which you can see the event from various different points of view, various facets. And then as you draw back further, you create a narrative of sorts, at least for the listener or for the reader. So, for example, one piece of the facet may distort some other pieces, or some pieces may not fit all together, or there might be gaps, and we sort of fill in those gaps with what our assumptions are about individuals and the events itself. So I think, first and foremost, we're talking about there is an objective reality. It is out there. Something's happening out there. The question then becomes, what do we know about that event, and how do we know it? What comes to inform our view of how we construct the narrative? And I think that's one of the basic questions, particularly in terms of social media. So when I think about today, I ran across from a quote by Daniel Dennett, American rationalist, and he says that the real danger that's facing us is that we've lost respect for truth and facts, that people have discovered that it's easier to destroy reputations for credibility than it is to maintain them. And so what is being really attacked in what may be a post-truth era, if that's what one wants to describe it as such, is it's not that the facts have changed any or the objects out there in the world have changed, but rather our ability to discern what the real narrative is. And I think that's something that that really begins to impinge upon us, especially when we begin to think about, for instance, social media. In the past, we had basic gatekeepers, whether it's newspapers or then it was major news news organizations, they operate as gatekeepers, keeping filtering out a lot of the facets that don't either apply or have no credibility. Now all of that's being flooded into us through social media, whether it's Twitter or it's Facebook or so on, and now we're looking at at the world, and it's all got a bunch of facets, and we're then picking out little chunks of it, knitting those together to create our own narrative.
That's an interesting sort of notion. That have we given up the idea of truth for narrative, right? That we think that there often is should be some relation between the two, right? That a narrative is how we express truth. But in an era where we have sort of so many narratives going on, particularly on social media, is the narrative now the stand-in for truth?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, narrative and truth always relate to each other in some way. But I think it's important to remember, too, that what Don started with is this idea that the hope is that what we're getting at is reality, right? So you've got reality and you've got truth, and truth is my attempt to conform to reality, right? So I'm being truthful when I try to only say things that are real and I try to avoid things that aren't. The idea of narrative, I think, gets at the fact that my way of putting together reality, even if that's something as simple as having a political ideology, that might affect the way that I interpret certain facts. Some facts I might be more skeptical towards, some I might ignore, and then some I might sort of hammer home over and over again. But those are all choices that people are going to make. So I think there is something changing in the landscape, but if you talk about a fact, right, fact is really what we know about an event. And in order to have something like knowledge, you need to have this kind of desire to have the truth and to get at the truth, but you also need something like a clear standard of evidence. So I think one of the things about social media that's interesting is not just that there isn't something like a gatekeeper, but that one of the things the gatekeeper would do is establish what counts as evidence and what doesn't count as evidence. Whereas in social media, just by putting it up, it kind of automatically has a presumption of evidential value.
And the greater number of hits it gets increases its truth value, it seems.
One of the, you know, one of Plato's oldest examples is that you're not going to go and have a democratic vote in order to diagnose you of a disease, right? Like, all of us want to go to a doctor who just knows how to cure the disease rather than just asking everybody's opinion, what do you think I have? And I think, you know, in a strange way, our current zeitgeist would maybe disagree with Plato. People are more interested in just kind of hearing everyone's opinion and having that kind of democracy of opinions rather than something like expertise.
Exactly. I always think of the example of, the car wreck, where you have an intersection and you can have four people at each point of the intersection and two cars slam into each other. And so we have certain objective facts, right? One car hit another or however it is. But you ask each one of the people who've seen it, and they often have four different narratives about how it occurred, right? And so again, that we have certain facts that we can assert, two cars slammed into each other, X, Y, and Z happened. But that again, the notion of what is true about that becomes more complicated the more views you have on it. We recognize in investigating a car accident that the cops will listen to all four perspectives and try to piece together the truth. But when we have 100 different people looking at this, right, how do we sort of ascertain what the truth is in that way? And again, it comes back to the fundamental question of how do we define notions of truth, right? And that philosophically this has changed over the centuries in some ways. And so, Tim, I'm wondering if you might sort of give us just a brief overview of the history of philosophical senses of truth. It's a large question and a short amount of time to address it, but...
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to. I mean, I'll talk about this stuff all day, but... the first thing I'd say is that there's no way I could give an adequate accounting of the history of philosophy on truth. It's one of the oldest questions. It's one that's changed dynamically over time, and people have had a lot of thoughts about it. I would say that there are some sort of standard ways of thinking about truth. One of them is, I already referred to, is this idea of correspondence with reality. That's called the correspondence theory of truth. So the idea is that I make statements, and I try to make those statements to be as accurate as possible in representing the real. I say this table is hard and I knock it, right, as evidence of that, and that sense that I'm conforming to reality is important. Another important way of thinking of the truth that is also good to think about is the coherence theory of truth, which is that truth is also about what kinds of what kinds of facts we put together and whether or not those facts cohere with each other. Now, I could have a coherent sense of fact, a coherent set of facts that doesn't necessarily correspond with every single way of interpreting an event. But still, coherence is a good standard if I think that, well, everything I say should sort of hang together. There shouldn't be any kind of inconsistency just in the sentences that I utter. I'm also interested, though, in kind of looking at, I know you mentioned postmodernism, and that can be a very tricky subject. Postmodernism is this very diverse phenomenon and whatever. But one of the things I think that people are acknowledging now is that there's a sense that truth also has a kind of a currency or a social value or is tied somehow to power. So if I have more political power, I do have a greater ability to determine what's taken for granted in a given situation.
Yeah.
So I don't think that, you know, postmodernism as such is an attempt to, like, assail the truth and destroy the truth. But it's more an acknowledgement of the fact that you have to look at certain historical, political, and social factors in terms of what facts have the most currency, what facts are the most valuable.
Okay. Don, how have you seen this play out in the world of journalism recently?
What happens is that you get, first and foremost, you get a fragmentation. The most obvious is perhaps in cable television, where you have, say, Fox, for instance, which presents one particular viewpoint and emphasizes certain issues and certain events. MSNBC will have another point of view and emphasize other events and other interpretations. CNN, we like to think, is sort of in the middle somewhere. But again, even in their own program, there are these various breakdowns. But then as you move away from the traditional gatekeepers, you get a kaleidoscope of all kinds of views. But then those views, I think, begin to organize themselves into frames of reference and ideology. It's almost like a group of cells which are now beginning to form a body, right, in which it has some function. So now you've got a situation where if I look at, for instance, a political speech, I have a certain frame of reference that have a set of beliefs. So if I'm a conservative, for example, and believe in, say, the free markets is, like, above everything else, then everything that's said by, say, a political figure or a set of data, I'm going to see through that lens. And those things that don't conform to market good, I'm going to dismiss, right? Or I'm going to downplay. On the other hand, if I'm say, a progressive who believes in active government, for example, then I'm going to be looking at it from a different direction, i.e., if an industry says something, I'm going to be very skeptical about it, as opposed to I might be less skeptical about, say, if a government official tells me something that's, say, from a research point of view. So you get this. So when you're trying to, like, then provide news and information to people, you have to understand that when they're listening to what you are writing or when you're listening to what they're saying, they view you through a particular lens. And their judgment from your point of view may not be valid, but from their point of view, it is. And I think that's the fragmentation that I think that we see exists. So on the one hand, yes, we have a zillion sort of points of view, but then they begin to cohere into these sort of groups and these sort of views of the world. And I think that's the thing that is difficult. I ran across, by the way, somebody did a study. And they said people, and they said, well, you know, if they were more egalitarian and more communitarian, they tend to be suspicious of industry, and they call for government regulation. On the other hand, if they're more hierarchical, more individualistic, they respect industry and are suspicious of government. You can see just from that simple frame, you can see where when you hear somebody talk, whether it's Donald Trump or it's a Democratic nominee or whether it's a government official or an industry official, those things are going to begin to decide what you think is more true or is true at all, as opposed to what's not true.
So have we then, in that sort of sense, become far more ideological in the way that we view facts themselves, right? If we would like to think that perhaps a previous model is you observe a fact, right, whatever that fact is, and try to understand that in terms of your worldview, right? The fact comes first, and we try to explain it to ourselves from our perspective of our worldview. Have we inverted that, right? Where now we approach everything primarily from our ideological position and then accept or disregard the facts if they work with that ideology?
Well, I think we have a traditional, I think in the past we've always had a traditional cultural point of view, whether, you know, if you were out in, for instance, the rural areas, you might be, say, more conservative, even times past, right? And you would view the government officials one way as opposed to, say, somebody in a city. I think what's happened here is that there's a fluidity of ideology. And that it begins constantly shifting around. I mean, you think of, for instance, Donald Trump has come out and said he opposes free trade. He wants tariffs and so on. Complete contradiction to the Republican Party stance, of which is supported free trade. That's an interesting shift that's gone on inside the Republican Party. Hmm. One of the future questions for the Republican Party, will they stay with that anti-free trade position, or will, once Donald Trump is gone, shift back? And can they shift back, given the fact that their base has now been so inundated, probably at least for 4 to 5 years, even if it only serves one term, in which, no, they believe that, no, free trade's bad. So as a Republican, then, do you run on free trade, or has the ground shifted down below, and now it's become much more fluid than perhaps it was in the past?
I think that you also have to be careful. Not that I'm jumping on anything you're saying, Don, but, you know, if you go all the way back to Plato's Republic, Plato was aware of the strength of ideology and the strength of popular opinion. He has a famous example where he talks about the noble lie. He says every single city has to have one noble lie, and everyone knows it's false, but everyone believes it to be true because it creates a kind of social cohesion. And then he has this wonderful discussion of the noble lie for his own society is that people are born with certain kinds of souls. There are gold souls and silver souls and brass souls. And the important part of that is that it's a metaphor for sort of class and class mobility. Mm. Like a gold soul could have a silver soul as a child, right? But it's unlikely that a silver soul is going to have a gold soul as a child. So that noble lie is a kind of a justification for the hierarchy of the civilization of their time. So I don't think it's fair to say that ideological commitments are new. I think the hard thing that the difficulty we're having right now is distinguishing between people who genuinely are ideologically motivated. Like, they just want their political position or their moral position or their religious position to be true. And then people who might agree with one or another part of that, but aren't themselves ideological. Like, oftentimes in online discussions, if you advocate a certain point of view, you're just automatically labeled as being ideological. And it's like, well, I might not adhere to all parts of this ideology, but I think we expect people to have a high degree of ideological coherence at this point. So anyone advocating any progressive policy becomes a progressive. Anyone who says anything positive about Donald Trump has to be a conservative, you know?
Or even more so a racist, or, you know, we think about how this sort of extends. And so again, go ahead.
Well, there was one more thing I wanted to say, which is that when you make these kind of historical analyses, you also have to be careful because, you know, maybe it's the case that we used to have more of a consensus kind of back in the day, but maybe it's the case that there was just a consensus that papered over a lot of difference that we're now becoming aware of. Maybe we're just, maybe it could be healthy in that we're actually recognizing that within our society we have a plurality of ideological commitments, a plurality of histories, and that our own society looks very different. I mean, it's hard if you're in an elementary school to say something critical of George Washington, right? I mean, I don't think anyone wants to beat up on George Washington. But that means I have a certain ideological commitment to the notion that he was somehow a good guy.
But one of the things, this is what I would say. For instance, if you live in a village, for instance, right, access to multiple flows of information is extremely limited, tends to be part of a group that has a tendency to think with dominant ideas about how the world is constructed. I think what's happened now is that that village has been blown apart. So now we create virtual villages, as it were, right, through social media, and that coherence that the small village created has now been perhaps even completely broken down. Much as, for instance, maybe if you think about, for instance, when people moved to the cities, I suspect that to a certain extent there was a breakdown there of this cultural coherence that they might have had when they were in the village. Now they come to the city, they're exposed to all these other people who are not like them, and they get different ideas and form different concepts of how the world is put together. So, I mean, I think it gets a sort of shifting going on in terms of where people are, what they think, and their particular condition. But one of the things I think is very important to keep in mind is that we have moved from very small communities, such as the Greeks, for example, which had city-states, right? They would be coherent. Now, to this vast country and this vast world where you have all kinds of people and ideas flowing in on one another. One of the big questions when the founding of the country was whether or not democracy could actually be viable over such a large piece of territory. And that I think basically down didn't even really extend to the Mississippi at the time. So there was some question about just the diversity of the individuals. But as we grow tighter together in terms of our ability to communicate, I think it breaks apart that cultural cohesion that perhaps we had in the past.
So that's an interesting sort of proposition, right? So has the pluralism that we see now in our contemporary culture and the sort of global culture that we are in, does pluralism itself negate the idea of having singular actual truths anymore, right? Has truth become tribalistic in some ways, to sort of use a language that a lot of people are talking about these days?
I think it certainly can. I mean, there's still a whole bunch of issues. I don't think that would describe everything that's going on. I mean, one thing that jumps out at me is just the fact that, one thing that's kind of counterintuitive is that liars, for example, tend to be heavily invested in knowing the truth. Because to lie effectively, I actually have to know pretty well what happened right, so that I can dance around the fact. So there, some of these things are kind of counterintuitive. I think that the pluralism you're describing it would mean that there isn't something like an absolute truth. But at the same time, all of those tribes, all of those, all of those pockets of whether it's ideological or cultural or even just, geographical, where you happen to live and what access you have to information, all of those people are going to have things that they hold to pretty high standards of truth. And so one of the tricky things about pluralism is that often pluralism means that these small groups do have very strong commitments to the truth. It's just that those communities don't necessarily see eye to eye in terms of what should be the standard.
Well, in that sort of sense of these different communities seeing things differently is sort of one thing. But if we ask questions, say, for example, connected to science, right? We think about the sort of anti-vaccine notions that a lot of people have, even though science has quite clearly demonstrated that these vaccines help children from getting terrible diseases, but you still have people who insist that the truth is something different, right? Is this something that we're seeing more of, a sort of flat-out rejection by certain groups or social institutions of simply rejecting fundamental facts, right? We think of discussions about climate change even, where the statistics are something like 89% of all scientists agree in climate change, and yet there are some people who still refuse to believe that it's actually a thing. And so, how do actual scientific facts come into accord? Now, of course, science changes over time, but when we think about things that science has fundamentally established for us, and yet we have people who willfully reject scientific fact, how do we work with that in a contemporary culture?
I mean, well, one of the things that happens is, I think, for instance, with the people who don't believe in having their children vaccinated, is they don't say, "I just simply believe that it's a bad thing." They say, "Oh, here are all the scientific facts that prove, right, that this is not a good thing." Or climate change is another example of where you won't simply hear somebody say, "Well, I don't believe it," but rather they say, "But here are the statistics that tell me." One of the effective techniques in terms of both the tobacco industry and climate change is to create doubt. So, for instance, with the cigarette industry, the object of the game was to create doubt about whether or not cigarettes were unhealthy. That's all they had to do, right, to allow their industry to continue. Oddly enough, some of the same people who participated, by the way, in those campaigns are now wound up in the climate change denial community, which I think is absolutely fascinating. So it's doubt and skepticism are good, but I think what's happened here is that it's led to this point where you don't believe X or you doubt X, and then somebody else gives you something else Y that you can believe in, and all based upon what looks like science, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, part of the real debate that happens in this question of, how reliable is science is just that it's difficult to tell the difference between science and pseudoscience, especially if you're a non-expert. So sometimes it's not necessarily that science is bad, but science is hard. And science attempts to answer questions that are incredibly complex. So one of the things that's going on, and I agree that this is all really quite worrying in a sense, but one of the things that goes on with the vaccine situation is that people have this tremendous psychological bias towards simplification. They simply want an answer to be clear, and they want to know what to do in a given situation. And when you take something as complicated as public health that involves all these different factors, you're not necessarily going to get a simple answer, right? You can get maybe some good data about likelihoods or probabilities or things like that. But as a parent, I'm always going to have this huge psychological bias to say, look, tell me what's right and what's wrong. And so that desire to simplify things, I think, is just as much behind something. And it applies equally to climate change. I would add with climate change that, you know, one of the most worrying psychological fallacies that people engage in is called the fallacy of optimism, which is that I have this huge psychological bias to believe that things will work out well. And one of the reasons people are so resistant to even discussing climate change is just the fact that there's a likelihood that things will not work out well at all, and that actually we're talking about mitigating catastrophe in the next 50 to 100 years. And that's not a conversation that's easy to have, even just from a psychological point of view.
I'd like to kind of tie this together. Don, you sort of mentioned a skepticism, right? And mm-hmm. we think that skepticism is often a healthy thing, right? It's what allows us to evaluate the world around us and to evaluate the truths as they are presented to us. But have we become sort of a culture of skepticism, right, where there is an overwhelming suspicion of everything these days, right? I think of the examples where we sort of see where a tweet that someone made a number of years ago is sort of recovered. It's problematic in terms of its perspective on race or gender or sexuality or any number of sort of things. And that even though the individual may say, yeah, that was a mistake, I shouldn't have said that, I think differently now, that we still have this sort of, no, you made that one statement, you are a racist, you are a sexist, right? Where the skepticism overrides a belief perhaps in the idea of change or the idea of difference or the idea of even having just made a mistake. Are we so skeptical now that truth itself is something that we don't really hold on to as a center anymore?
Well, I think in terms of like, particularly in terms of the incidents, like for instance, the governor of Virginia and the attorney general, having appeared in blackface,
right,
in this 1980s book,
the medical yearbook, right,
your medical yearbook. So if you look at the reactions, particularly in African American community, there are some, and particularly in Virginia, there are many who say, well, you know, the governor should be, he's changed. He clearly has taken a whole set of positions. We feel, you know, we believe in redemption and change like that. But there are others within the African American community that I've heard where it's not enough. And so why would someone then say that? And I think they're saying it because it's part of a historical experience, a social movement, as it were, which can be extremely unforgiving. And so we're not talking about simply, say, discussing it in a classroom. We're talking about highly emotional issues, things that people have personally experienced. So, for instance, if you're African American in this country, you've experienced all kinds of discrimination and adverse things, everything from the very small things to maybe some large things. That builds a certain view that at the end of the day, you may not be willing to forgive, you know, so-and-so something that they did 20 or 30 years ago just because of all the things that have happened to you. That's different than, say, rationally sitting down and saying, ah, you know, it was 20, 30 years ago. He's done a lot more now. Everything should be okay. We won't forget, but we think he's changed. So I think when you look at those kinds of non-forgiveness, as it were, I think that's the thing that you have to kind of like keep in mind when it comes to acceptance of somebody's past transgressions. On the other hand, I mean, if there's a pattern, you know, that becomes another issue. But it just singular things that happen, or that when you're very young, that kind of thing. We tend to be forgiving in many ways. I mean, I guess Bill Clinton is one of the classic examples where he was forgiven by people, you know, even before Monica Lewinsky. I guess Donald Trump has been forgiven for whatever transgressions he has, at least by a certain portion of the population, as opposed to the others saying, hey, you know, this is an ongoing problem. So I think in that sense, I think when you think about those one-time incidents, it's not so much that they're skeptical, although they are skeptical, but they're skeptical from a particular position given their own personal experience and how they reacted, how they've interacted with it.
Well, that sort of hints to leads to a tricky question, right? The idea of experience itself as being far more important than objective truth, right? And that we see a lot of arguments, sort of people talking about, but I view things this way because of my lived experience, And is that becoming a substitute for truth in some ways, that the individual experience is now more valid in argumentation than truth itself?
I think that, you know, so there was a philosopher who wrote a really popular book a few years ago. His name is Harry Frankfurt. I can't apparently say the title of the book on the radio, but it was on BS will be is my abbreviation of the book. But one of the things he discussed is exactly this phenomenon. Towards the end of the book, in a classic kind of twist, he starts talking about sincerity as opposed to BS. And he actually thinks this idea of sincerity, or, hey, I'm just being sincere, or, hey, this is just my honest opinion, that those are just as pernicious as something like just BSing all the time, right? And so I do think that you can overemphasize experience, but at the same time, what these phenomena show is that we also have a very low amount of charity for acknowledging each other's experiences. Mm. So, you know, when the thing about reality is that it just kind of keeps coming back. So if you have this instance in Virginia where a person who's ostensibly a liberal in the Democratic Party turns out to have a racist history, then the real issues of race are just going to bubble up around that thing. And in a sense, it's not the guy's fault. But the discourse around it is going to reflect the fact that there are real, real issues, and people are going to have to speak to their experience to some degree. The question is, do I approach that situation saying, hey, can I learn something from this, right? Or do I immediately get defensive and say, well, your experience isn't my experience, so one of us has to be wrong.
Okay. One of the things, and Tim, you hinted at this a little while ago by mentioning postmodernism, and that there have been a number of arguments that have been made from both left and right political perspectives, that the post-truth era that we appear to be in, if we want to call it that, is really emerging out of postmodern philosophy that was popping up in the 60s through the 80s, we might say, that the postmodern philosophers were fundamentally skeptical of the very idea of truth itself, right? You think of thinkers such as Jacques Derrida or Jean-Francois Lyotard, who their fundamental projects were often aimed at taking apart established notions of truth, right? And suggesting that dominant groups pick and choose their facts and impose those on subordinate groups, and this is how truth is created, right? And so by exposing these things that we are somehow liberating ourselves from truth, right? And these politics, these philosophies largely emerged from left-leaning intellectuals, but we've also seen that now taken up by more conservative thinkers, right? We even think of the famous Kellyanne Conway alternative facts statement, right? Which, you know, when a lot of people heard that, thought, well, that's just an absurd sort of notion. But that very idea of there are not singular facts, there are all kinds of facts that we can work with, have really emerged out of certain strains of postmodern philosophy, which, again, you know, started being taught to students, university students, late 60s, all through the 80s and the 90s, and we still see a lot of this. Do we see that fundamental connection to how people are viewing truth these days, right? These philosophies, which were very much isolated universities and institutions, have they now simply filtered out in such a widespread way that this is sort of ubiquitous at this point?
Yeah, I have to chuckle with questions like this because I don't know whether to say that, yeah, a bunch of French philosophers in the 1970s, you know, just by writing some books changed the world, because I'm tempted to say that philosophers can do that. But there's this weird thing where I think people can both overemphasize and underemphasize the role of philosophy. One thing that those philosophers might be doing is just they might be reflecting changes that are already happening in their culture. Right. So I'm not sure that they caused anything to happen. But I do think that it's important to acknowledge, first off, that postmodernism is a very diverse philosophical field.
And
you have many different thinkers, many of whom disagreed with each other. So Foucault and Derrida, for example, famously debated back and forth on a number of issues. And so they don't necessarily neatly map onto a political spectrum. But having said that, I think part of what's going on in this era is, number one, an acknowledgement that the interpretation of fact plays as much of a role as the facts themselves. Mm-hmm. That it's actually a kind of deception to say that there is this objectivity that's just out there. And it's really just a question of whether or not you're tapping into that reality. So interpretation is very important. But at the same time, I sort of look at it on a broader historical canvas where interpretation has always been important. I mean, if you look at just the diversity of Christian sects in our own area, these are people who just interpret that religion very differently. And the difference in their interpretation really does create different kinds of Christianity, different possibilities for Christianity. So I do think that it's, in a sense, it's always been the case that interpretation matters. But I do also think that there is a feeling always with truth that if you degrade it too much, you might lose some of the fabric that allows us to have a political or social discourse in the first place. And so it is certainly worrisome if that kind of thinking, that emphasis on interpretation, gets turned into a kind of crass politics where anyone can say whatever they want.
Is religion, though, an interesting example of this, since a belief in God is fundamentally grounded on something that cannot be scientifically verified, right? We people have their beliefs in God.
Oh, for sure. And beliefs matter.
Right.
Definitely.
So is that an interesting example to think of today in how people are viewing truth, right? That similar to religious beliefs where I believe it because I believe it because I have faith, not because I have some scientific evidence of it, are we seeing that really emerging in more ideological ways these days, in which it doesn't matter if there are fundamental facts that verify this, but I believe this ideologically, so therefore I assert that it is true?
Well, it's certainly true of, like, religion. And I think this is where, you know, there's belief, right, which tends, I think, either be something that we cannot be proved, right? We can't use a scientific method. So, for example, you know, I mean, people, for instance, there are some people who view the Bible as literal in its interpretation, that these things actually happen. And now, obviously, there are others who see it as metaphorical in nature. So it doesn't matter whether the actual event occurred, for instance, in Jesus' life, the truth of the parable or the story is more important than what we consider to be Western facts and figures. But so I think that people, if, for instance, when they look at, for instance, evolution as an example, or how old the Earth is, there is if they have a fundamental belief, for whatever reason, in the literal interpretation, then all of this makes sense in terms of, well, the Earth can't be more than 10 or 6,000 years old, et cetera, et cetera. And when we've got that sort of thing, you know, with the Scopes trial of 1925 and the teaching of evolution and so on. So I think from that point of view, I think belief plays a great role. But also belief and ideology in general, they have their own, I think they create their own reality, which has an effect on reality itself. So, for example, we can say, I don't want my kid to be vaccinated. A whole bunch of other people then decide to do that, right? Now, let's assume for the moment that this is not true, that vaccination is a good thing. But the fact that they believe it doesn't, they act on that belief, then creates an epidemic, say the measles, for instance, outbreak of measles. So the way we organize ideas and form them around our own fundamental beliefs can have a tendency to then have an impact on what we could think of as the real world, the physical world that's outside of ourselves.
I think that's a great example with the idea of, you know, certain things in order to be real require lots of people to do them. And herd immunity, right, is a great example of something where you need lots and lots of people to all work together. So that's definitely a great example. I think another kind of example is we get from history, and it is political, which is that one of the real tools that oppressive and authoritarian and fascist governments have had is to use the truth as a kind of loyalty test. So if the fascist has the capacity to tell a lie and have that believed, that's almost a kind of a purity test. And the people who get on board with the lie are then included in political power. The people who object to the lie are excluded. And I think that that can play out in a number of ways. But I also think that there is, maybe on a smaller scale, that's just an ordinary social phenomenon. I might ask people what their beliefs are simply to know whether or not I want to have a certain conversation with them. So it's not necessarily nefarious. I think it's something everybody does, but we have to be aware of it. I would also say, from that perspective, that all of these things are things that you can correct for. And if there's any significance for philosophy in the present day, it's that philosophers tend to emphasize critical thought. And critical thought is really the acknowledgement that all of our thinking has these problems. They could be psychological, they could be social, they could be ideological or cultural. And critical thought is where you take a breath and you say, I have to look over my own process of thinking and see what errors I can identify and how I can correct those things. It might be a little bit optimistic, but I do feel as if it's a good thing when people develop the capacity to be self-reflective about how much they really know about a certain subject.
Well, and this is an interesting notion that we have, again, an assertion of facts very often from people who don't really know much. That, again, we can, you know, we think of the internet or any sort of things where people can simply assert things because they want to assert them that have no basis in fact at all, or are playing very loose with the facts, right? And so again, we think about that tribalism, but we also seem to see an increase in sort of the very conspiracy idea of the world that, you know, because again, conspiracy theorists, there's always some kernel of fact somewhere in it. But then they sort of build entire complex narratives around it, which not only tinker with certain facts, but reject anyone who might disagree with it, right? I mean, the sort of old notion that if you disagree with a conspiracy theorist, you're all of a sudden part of the conspiracy, right? And I mean, is given that sort of growing skepticism and almost conspiratorial sense, are we simply rejecting the views of others simply because they don't fit into our sort of conspiracy narratives? And is this more prevalent now than it was 20, 30 years ago?
I would think this, and I'm influenced by something I read, but it seems to be that the 1960s with the war, Lyndon Johnson, Watergate, the environmental movement got off to, because they found that industry wasn't telling the truth, that sort of thing. I think that that was probably the decade into the 1970s, which I think really spawned what we now see as people latching on to all kinds of conspiracies, mm-hmm. right? And it's not that people didn't have, you know, a sense of conspiracies before. I mean, we look at the populists of the late 1800s, for example, and they had a certain conspiratorial view of what was going on in the East. You know, now some of it could be very well true. I'll be clear about that. But nonetheless, so we have had conspiracies. There was, for instance, in this country, there was a sense of conspiracy by Catholics and the Pope, and a very violent one, I might add, by the way. Right. And other various groups as well. So we've always had conspiracies, but I think in when those. When that social fabric began to break down in those particular two decades, I think we saw people being very skeptical, obviously, of the government and skeptical of business, but then also in that skepticism, forming conspiracy theories about who was behind what. So the point where you get this situation where in 9/11, you now have 9/11 truthers in right. which they don't believe that the planes actually went and had to be, you know, conspiracy by the Bush administration, which, you know, it doesn't make any sense, but there is this sense about, well, there's something else going on here, and we just don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's not just human fallibility. It's got to be pieced together. And in one sense, I mean, it's sort of how we sort of try to put the world together. I mean, as we, even in our inner office politics and so on, we kind of like figure out who's friends with whom and so on and so forth. And then we have some idea about, okay, and we can build these conspiracies even in our own backyard. Mm-hmm. But I think that particular period, I think, really sprang a lot of this stuff, whether it's fragmentation, skepticism, or even conspiracy. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, one of the things we're kind of, I think it's interesting that we're going in a circle on this, but it's hard to determine how much is proper to this post-truth era
right.
and how much has gone on, because I would point to things like the Illuminati and all these
right,
kind
exactly,
of Catholic
yeah.
conspiracies that, you know, there have always been conspiracy theories. Philosophers tend to think that that just the fact of there being a conspiracy is reason to have extra skepticism. So that's one thing. But also then, I always try to think about, why is this person advocating this conspiracy right now, right? What are the motives behind conspiracy? A lot of times you can peel apart a conspiracy theory just by acknowledging that it's sort of convenient to the teller that a certain conspiracy be true. So that's something you definitely want to keep in mind. But again, one of the things that we haven't talked about, but it's really important, is that truth certainly has a certain kind of value, but we can also be deceived. And one way to gain advantage over other people, whether that's financial or political or whatever, is to deceive them. And so people who tend to advocate conspiracy theories are good at knowing what sorts of things people are psychologically vulnerable for towards. And they can be surprising. I mean, one of my favorite fallacies is called the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, which is this idea that a sharpshooter, or not a sharpshooter, sort of pulls out his guns and shoots at a barn and just randomly spreads all these shots all over it and then walks up to it and paints a target on the ones that are grouped together, right? And says, hey, I'm a sharpshooter. Well, this actually happens, you know, one of the most famous contemporary cases of this is the Aaron Brockovich case, where actually there was this huge settlement, there was a movie made about it, apologies to Julia Roberts fans, but it turns out in later epidemiology studies that actually the chemical that was released in the water did not cause a statistically significant higher rate of cancer. So here you even have a legal settlement that came out of this compelling narrative, right? But really, at the end of the day, there was just this kind of grouping of two things, the higher amount of chemicals in the water and the higher amount of cancer rates, and they just happened to be grouped together, and sometimes that happens. It doesn't mean that there's a target there.
In that sort of way, do we even think of conspiracy theories as not as less a rejection of truth as much as a desperate attempt to find some truth, right? Because again, we even think about the 9/11 truthers, as you sort of mentioned, that they believe that they are liberating people by exposing, you know, the government cover up and X, Y, and Z sort of things. And so is it in some ways less an attack on truth than a desperate attempt to find truth to make things make sense, right? To have things be ordered in some ways, right? And so again, is it responding to a cultural crisis, right? An anxiety about truth that leads people to desperately cling to notions that are absurd and yet give them some meaning as a centering truth, right?
I would suggest this, that conspiracies give people power. This idea that if you can see what the mosaic is, you're now more powerful and more discerning than the person who doesn't, right? And then you can act on whatever fashion that you want to. I would suggest in many ways it's a way to try to gain control of our reality by saying these are not just random events, but I can make sense of them, whatever happens to be, whether you're skeptical of the government or industry or somebody's got to be lying, somebody's doing something bad to me, that kind of thing. That's, I think, one of the things that conspiracy theories give people is that ability to say, I've got now control of my world. Because, I mean, one of the worst things in the world for individuals is to feel like they don't have control of their lives. They don't have control of the world around them. I mean, that's devastating emotionally and physically. But if you can knit the world together and be able to see what it is, even if there's some terrible evil that you think is conspiring, that gives you at least some kind of control and power over, oddly enough, the conspiracy itself.
I think also that's a great point, especially about this idea of control, right? So philosophers talk about the idea of agency, which is the way that individuals can cause things to happen, right? So when I throw the ball across the room, I'm sort of expressing this agency that I can make things happen. Well, we also know, if you look at things like conspiracy theories, that people tend to have a pretty inflated sense of agency, and they also tend to ascribe agency to things that don't really have it. I happened to just rewatch, I don't know why I'm talking about 90s movies, but I rewatched Armageddon with my family because one of my boys was curious about it. And it's about this asteroid crashing into the Earth. And then these pluckish miners who go and fly up to the asteroid to blow it up. So this is a great example of like inflated agency. Number one, my son kept asking me, well, what is the asteroid doing? What does it want to do? Why is it trying to hurt us? And so I'm like, well, it's a rock, right? It's not trying to do anything. But it's reasonable for him to say that because the whole way that the movie is framed is as the struggle of kind of man versus rock, right? And there's a way in which it's totally improbable that this is going to happen. If it does happen, there's probably not much we can do about it. But that's so uncomfortable that I need to find agency somewhere. And so I create a story about these miners that are able to defeat even this large space rock that, you know, should be wiping us out.
Well, so are we coming back to the notion that the primary truth that individuals begin to hold these days is the truth of themselves? right? That we no longer have grounding truth anymore, be they God, be they whatever it is, some philosophical truth, that the notion that, no, the only truth that I can trust is my own self, which, of course, is a phenomenally dangerous notion. But is that sort of the trajectory, do we think?
I mean, isn't, in the end, ourselves is the only thing we really have? And that, however, did we determine what inputs we value, and that, it's all about us. to be very honest, I mean, so that our own personal experience, we can try to look beyond ourselves. But our own personal experience, I think, is probably one of the most dominant teachers of how we view the world. Interesting examples, for instance, if you watch, the evening news, and you see a lot of like crime stories and that kind of thing, eventually you're going to think that crime is up, even though crime is actually down. Well, why is that? It's because they've absorbed these experiences as part of their personal experiences. That's one of the things that's really interesting about television and media in general, is you absorb them and they become part of who you are. And I mean, even the characters can be seen like they're real, right? Even though if you looked at the filming, of course, there's the cameras and the rest of it. So the actors, the experience of the film is much different for them because they can see behind the scenes, whereas these become real people. I mean, soap operas are another classic example. Right. So I think we absorb these things as a personal experience, and then we look out at the world and we say, okay, does this check with what we think or our own personal experience? So I think in that way, I think personal experience really has a very serious impact on how we view the world and what we think is true and what's not.
I think that, you know, it's a good thing that people believe in science, and it's a good thing that people believe in God, and it's a good thing that people believe in democracy, and it's a good thing that people have values. If I were to say anything is distinctive of the current era, it's that we don't allow people to be confused and ambiguous and have struggles. I mean, we desire a kind of purity test. So if I believe in God, then absolutely everything I ever think about has to somehow be tied to this notion that I believe in God. If I'm confident about science and I think it can make a positive social impact, well, then science has to be able to save the world from every possible catastrophe. And so I think I would really emphasize the idea that if I believe something to be true, that doesn't necessarily mean that I have to purify my life ideologically around that. I think that's the more dangerous notion.
So in sort of trying to wrap this up, do we imagine that we are moving further and further away from truth? Or is this just cyclical, where we are in a moment perhaps of cultural crisis, and therefore our trust in the truth has been shaken? Will we find that again, or are we simply experiencing, you know, what Thomas Kuhn describes as a fundamental paradigm shift in how we view truth itself?
Well, certainly as a country, and perhaps even as a globe, but certainly as a country, we are moving through some pretty dramatic shifts that are ahead. Probably one of the most dramatic is the demographic shift that's now taking place. And we can see this in elections. You know, in 1980, 85% of the electorate was white, who elected Ronald Reagan. Well, by the time you get to the last election, only 70%, and that percentage is expected to decline. And other experiences, as various ethnic groups and religious groups and so on, began to take a greater and greater hold. So, and this comes at just at a time when we have this massive social media phenomena that's occurring, in which people are now huddling in their virtual groups and that kind of thing. So I think when we're looking ahead, particularly as a country, I think we'll eventually see some settling out of how the demographics will play out, but also we'll begin to adjust to this new medium of social media. But it's going to take a while for people to figure out what to trust, not to trust. Just as, you know, when newspapers and publications and so on were first invented, it was disruptive as well. You know, any form of new communication is going to do that. I think in the end, maybe I'm being the optimist here, but I think that in the end we will adjust. But it's going to take a lot of time, and we're not quite sure. I mean, we talk about the idea about, well, free speech, and you know, what is that in terms of the new medium? And we tend to start, you know, define free speech from the old 18th century, 19th century concept of newspapers. Well, that's it's a completely different world now. We're going to have to adjust our view as to, well, what's free speech, what's not, how does it impact? Because it's much more devastating now than perhaps in the past.
All right. Don, Tim, thank you both for a fascinating conversation. In concluding our program, let me return to T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men and confess a bias. This is actually Hal's writing, but I'm reading this as if it's mine as well, although I tend to agree. My bias is that our current model of the way the world works, based on experience and scientific analysis, has served us well in establishing a practical basis on which to confirm the nature of truth. In this post-truth era, when truth might be culturally defined or not based on any evidence and determined only by what we want to believe, we may well be sliding into a time when, as Eliot says, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion. In our next program on truth and the post-truth era, we'll look at how society develops when faced with a postmodern world inundated with a constant, radical, unfiltered flow of information that shapes ever-challenging cultural models of reality. Thanks again to Don and Tim, and thank you all for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your stand-in host, Adam Wood.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.